Our guest tonight. We appreciate your coming to be with us. We hope that you'll come back if you can. We are in the midst of a great shuffle right now in people's lives with those who are very dear to us being away, heading off to another year of school. That affects a number of our families here. And with others who have come to our community to go to school this year. And we are thankful to have contact with a number of those young men and women. And we ask you to help us watch after them, help us pay attention to them, help us in our meetings like this to notice those faces that are guests with us and then to make them feel welcomed and loved. There are several sign-up sheets on the information desk out in the foyer here for different activities right now. Some of them relate to the work Aaron mentioned this morning, and one of them at least relates to the singing time, which John Davis folks are hosting next Saturday afternoon, I think at 4. Is it 4? Right. And there's a sign-up sheet for that on the table out front. It's just an informal singing time, a get-together. I think John's folks live out toward the Fellows Lake area. John will be glad to give you a ride if you need to do that. You talk to him about that. But sign up for 3 people, he says. He'd be glad to do that. We have folks that are in our prayers and take a bulletin and notice the long list and help us pray well for each other. We're nearing the end now of our 2 series this summer. And Sunday mornings we've been thinking about the Corinthian issues, how the church keeps its anchor strong in a culture that doesn't share its convictions. And then on Sunday evenings we're thinking our way through the minor prophets and thinking about the prophets and the nations and the people of God, and trying to think about the principles that help us when we look at a world like it is now in our time. And I hope you've noticed how many of the issues are the same. That's one of the things that strikes me, and with this one tonight I think that's what strikes me. Habakkuk. Maybe you don't know anyone named Habakkuk, but you'll share some of the thoughts of this great man, whoever he was, and you and I will need very much to learn from his experience as it's described in this book. We'll say a little more about him in a second. For now, look at his question. Oh Lord, how long? It's from chapter 1 and verse 2. This is a question that is raised, a question that comes to mind, a question that cries out for an answer. Whenever you find yourself in a circumstance where what you know about the providential rule of God, what you know about an all-powerful God who is active in the world and who works His will, does not match what you feel, what you're feeling in your personal experience. And you think about what I'm saying. When what you know about God's active rule, about His providential work, doesn't fit with what you look around and think you see at that moment. Some of you remember that when Rob Hadley was with us early in the summer in our Wednesday evening program, Rob encouraged us in his talk to not be too shallow in our thinking about the providence of God, but to be aware of how it will sound to people with broken hearts when we flippantly say, God will watch after you, or God will answer your prayers. The same kind of thing needs to be thought about when we're saying, as we did last week, God exercises His rule and His world even over the arrogant and the powerful. In this case, with Habakkuk, and Linda, you might go ahead to the point here. In this case, with Habakkuk, his question is one that I can find in both the Old and the New Testament. And I think that tells us it's pretty much a universal question or universal experience. In Psalm 13, at verses 1 and 2, listen to how this song begins. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? In other words, how long will I have to look around and it seem to me that evil is winning? How long before you take action and exercise your power and conquer the enemies that are breaking the hearts of your people? In the New Testament as well, this is a key idea in the great book of Revelation. In Revelation 6 and verse 10, when these seals in the book in the hand of the Lamb are being opened, we get to the crucial point and we see the souls of those who have been killed for their faith crying out from the altar, from beneath the altar in heaven, and they cry out, O Sovereign Lord, how long, Holy and True One, how long before you judge and avenge our blood upon those who dwell on the earth, the ones who are responsible for their loss? Think about it for a minute. Are there any things personally in your life that make you raise this question? Are there any ways where it doesn't seem to you that what would come along in your life in the wake of your committed faith in the Lord is what you expected? Are there any heartbreaks you don't think are fair? Are there any ways in which the problem of evil in this world touches your life where you wonder how there can be a powerful, wise, and good God and things still happen like they do to decent, sweet, and humble people? Or think about it this way. Are there any occasions in your life right now where you watch the news, you make yourself aware of world events, and you're made to wonder, how can this be if God is in charge? How can the good guys seem to be worn out so much? How, for example, the news today, how can a 12-year-old boy wear a belt of explosives into a wedding and kill 50 people? How can that stuff go on? How long, O Lord? And trying to cope with that question that arises naturally in life, this isn't a question by an unbeliever. This isn't a question by some bad fellow. This is a normal, natural question that comes to a thinking person. And what happens in Habakkuk is that this question leads to a developing complaint in the prophet's life. The developing complaint, and I've kind of broken it down. I'll start in with the three little points in just a second. But let me tell you a little about the circumstance. Habakkuk lives about the same time as the prophet Jeremiah. He comes along just after what we studied last week with Nahum. When Nahum was talking about Nineveh, Habakkuk lives just after the fall of Nineveh, or works just after that, only back in Jerusalem and Judea. Habakkuk is a man who cares very much about the moral and spiritual state of his people, not just the material prosperity of his people. Habakkuk's name means embrace. And the part of the drama of this book is he's having a hard time embracing the situation which in the ruling providence of God unfolds in history during his time. And what happens, and watch the three little thoughts here, my summary of really the first chapter or so of this book. And what happens is that it turns out that that nation that God raised up to bring judgment, to administer justice to the cruel Ninevites, the Assyrians of Nineveh, which seemed like such a good idea to our prophet last week, turns out now that that nation is also the vehicle God uses to bring judgment against the sins of Jerusalem as well. You know, that's one of the big problems that we have with justice. That which we want to hold other people to has to also be active in our own case. We want a God who is of purer eyes than to behold iniquity toward other people. With us, however, we'd like him to be slightly more lenient. And that's the part of the difficulty in this book. And when Habakkuk thinks about what he sees going on, he is a man who has been so concerned to look around among his own people and to see that the law is paralyzed and justice never goes forth, chapter 1 and verse 4. But when he learns that God's intention is to bring a people like the Assyrians, like the Babylonians that he raises up to judge the Assyrians, when he brings them down, now Habakkuk is astonished, just completely amazed that God, verse 13 says, that God would allow the wicked to swallow up the man who's more righteous than he. Verse 13. This is another form, in other words, of the problem of evil. How can God use the less righteous to bring judgment on those who are sinful, but still apparently more righteous than the ones who are bringing the judgment? How can God do that? Why would God do that? And that's the, how can God remain silent while the wicked seems to swallow up the more righteous? What do you think the answer to that question is? Is there one answer which always holds? Is there an explanation which is true in every case? You know, in the book of Job, which looks at another aspect of this problem of evil, Job's friends gave answers that were sometimes, might sometimes, in some cases, have been right. Their mistake was assuming they applied always. And it seems to me that the answers to this question are that way. There's not one that's always the case, but it's still God being wise enough to be God. So what Habakkuk does is the interesting part of this story. He's not the first or the last guy who is shocked by the process here. But what Habakkuk does is what a godly man ought to do with questions like this. In chapter 2, notice verse 1, he says, "I'll take my stand at my watch post and station myself on the tower." In other words, he's meeting his responsibility. He's filling his place. He doesn't know why things are happening like they are, but he's going to meet his responsibility and then look out and see what God will say to him and what the answer to his complaint will be. That's verse 1 of chapter 2. So let's do that for a few minutes. Let's take our place on the tower, so to speak, and try to see what the answers will be. And I want to tell you how I remember, or try to remember, the message of this little book of Habakkuk. To me, there are four great verses in this book. not only four, but four of them that serve as sort of the landmarks to me. And I believe that these four statements might help us to see how a man who's trying to embrace God in the midst of his questions can establish some convictions that keep him, even while his land is being invaded and he's having to watch it happen and to realize that God is allowing it. So these four great statements. The first one is in chapter 2, last part of verse 3 and then verse 4. God is telling him to write this down, and this is the vision that awaits the appointed time. And he says, if it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It's not upright within him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. There is the invasion coming, and it will be worked by someone who is arrogant and puffed up and not upright. That would be the terrible Chaldeans. But the righteous will live by his faith. You know, that last statement is a very important one in Scripture. The New Testament uses it three times in very significant settings. In Romans 1, after Paul has declared in verse 16 that he's not ashamed of the gospel, that it's the power of God to salvation to everyone who believes, he goes ahead and explains that it's written that the just shall live by his faith. He's quoting Habakkuk here. He's taking the principle Habakkuk learned and saying, here's how it works in the gospel. You and I benefit from what Christ has done for us in this way. In Galatians 3, in verse 11, it's quoted again, this time when Paul is trying to show that we are not obligated to the practices of the law, circumcision and all that kind of thing, as a ground for our hope in Christ. And his argument is, it couldn't be that God wanted us to be justified by the law because this prophet said that the righteous shall live by his faith, or at least God said to this prophet. And then the third time the New Testament uses this is in Hebrews 10 in verse 38. And in that case, the writer is trying to encourage worn out Christians that it's worth it for them to hang in there. And he quotes again from Habakkuk experience and encourages them to wait and not give up because the righteous live by faith and God takes no pleasure in those who turn back from it. This then turns out to be the main thing that's at stake in the book of Habakkuk. Can a man live by his faith? Can a man who looks around and is faced with questions and has complaints that are developing survive that? And Habakkuk is a man who, with reference to world events at least, faces that challenge. Now the second verse I'd like you to see is chapter 2, verse 14. Let me mention some of the things that in the intervening parts here that happen lead up to this. The Lord takes note of the fact that wealth and pleasure causes an arrogant man to never be at rest, and that greed is as wide as the grave, and death, like death, it never has enough. Chapter 2 and verse 5. And then he begins to show that this always leads to a cycle in which evil experiences the harvest that it sows for itself. There's always within evil the seeds of its own destruction. And the woes of Habakkuk begin to be enumerated. In chapter 2, verse 6, woe to him who heaps up what is not his own. For how long? Notice that take on our question. How long, O Lord? Then chapter 2, verse 9, woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to set his nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm. Somebody who thinks he's doing just fine on his own. Chapter 2, verse 12. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. And then it leads up to our statement, verse 14. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Some of you have sung that before. And it's a great, great thought. In the Old Testament, when God brought judgment against the Egyptians and upon the Egyptian gods through the plagues, what God was doing was not only delivering His people, but also judging evil. What happened is that the knowledge of God covered the face of the earth in that way. He was shown to be the real God. The Bible pictures the God's intention through Christ as being to bring about that time when, by dealing with the evil of man, the knowledge of the glory of the Lord covers the face of the earth. I think Habakkuk is quoting from Isaiah chapter 11. And I'd like you to think about this just listen for a second to it. This is the branch coming out, the spirit, branch from Jesse, and the Spirit of the Lord resting upon him. And notice what this says. And this is the coming of the Messiah. And his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see, or decide disputes by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will kill the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt of his waist, his faithfulness the belt of his loins. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the lion and the fattened calf together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play over the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child put his hand on the adder's den. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord, as the waters that cover the sea. The idea of God dealing with evil and protecting His people is caught up in this statement here. The third of the great verses in this wonderful little book would be chapter 2 and verse 20. But the Lord is in His holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before Him. We sing it sometimes as sort of a call to worship. That's not really what it is in Habakkuk. This is a solemn, an awe-filled statement of God's power and of His readiness to exercise necessary judgment over evil in the world, and especially toward idolatry. In this setting, at Habakkuk chapter 2 at verse 18, it says, what profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it a metal image, a teacher of lies? For its maker trusts in his own creation, and he makes speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, to a silent stone, arise. Can this teach? It's overlaid with gold and silver, and there's no breath in it. But the Lord's in His holy temple. He has life in Him. He has power in Him. He has will and energy about Him. He's not like a lifeless idol. In Psalm chapter 11, the 11th Psalm, there's an illustration perhaps of what this means. Evil is coming, and the people are advised to flee like a bird to their mountain because of the wicked. And in verse 4 of the Psalm, Psalm 11, it says, the Lord is in His holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes see, his eyelids test the children of men. The Lord tests the righteous, but his soul hates the wicked and the one who loves violence. And then there's this call for the Lord to act in keeping with his throne. Let him rain coals on the wicked. Fire and sulfur and a scorching wind shall be their portion of their cup. For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteous deeds. The upright shall behold his face. The Lord's in his holy temple. And the need that Habakkuk sees is to recognize God's right to rule, to believe that he's the living God and that he's there, and then to trust him. And that's what leads up to the fourth one of these great verses. In chapter 3, at verse 19, God the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. I would think of the deer here, not only the swiftness of his feet, but also the stability, the ability to walk on the high places, that the hills that might have been thought of in that time. His rising above the difficulty and his being safe and secure and able to deal with all of it. How does Habakkuk get to this point? Well, he remembers what he's heard that God has done before for his people. Friends, every week we come to Bible study. We have our classes Sunday morning, Wednesday night, and all of that. You know, we're not just learning stories. We're building a reservoir of knowledge about what God has done before that we're going to need to draw on when our faith is challenged by the kind of complaints that Habakkuk has. In chapter 3, at verse 2, for example, he says, "O Lord, I've heard the report of you, and your work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy." And then in verses 3 through 15, there is a summary in poetical terms of what God's deliverance of his people has been at some point in the past. Maybe it was during the time of the Exodus, I'm not sure. But the picture certainly fits there. And so, after recounting that to himself in his own mind, Habakkuk says in verse 16, "I hear, and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me." Watch this now. "Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us." Look what he's saying. I'm going to wait while we're being invaded, and then I'm going to wait for God to deal with those who invade us. That'd be hard to say about a land you loved, wouldn't it? Be real hard. Look at the beautiful way, maybe as beautiful a statement of commitment, of faith in the Lord as there is in the Bible, at Habakkuk 3, verses 17 and 18. "Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines." In other words, even though the stables of our pleasure and our enjoyment and our life is gone, "the produce of the olive fail and the fields yield no food," even though we're without what we depend upon in our diet, "the flock we cut off from the fold and there be no herd in the stalls," even if what we consider wealth is all gone. We have nothing to drink and enjoy, nothing to provide food to sustain us, nothing to give us any kind of wealth, even if that's all gone, "yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy and the God of my salvation. Now, what do you think? Has he turned into a fellow whose complaints are overcome by convictions so that he's going to live by faith? I think so. Has he gotten an answer as to why God decided to do it the way he did? Not a word. He just has been reminded that God is able to both deal with evil and to be trusted by his people. So let us, like this prophet, 600 BC maybe, leave here tonight saying, God, the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places, my obstacles, my difficulties. He makes me an overcomer. Is that what you are in your life? Is there something that we need to pray together about tonight before we go to face the week? Are you someone who's been intending to make the good confession and to be baptized into Christ? If that's on your mind, why don't you follow through with it? If we can help you to do it, it'd be our joy if you'll come tonight while we stand and sing this song.